We have with us today Shelby Steele, who is a conservative author, columnist, and documentary filmmaker. Dr. Steele is a recipient of the National Humanities Medal and a Robert J. and Marion E. Oster Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's also the author of many books, including The Content of Our Character, White Guilt, and his most recent work, Shame, How America's Past Sins Have Polarized Our Country. In addition, Dr. Steele has written extensively for many major publications, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Harper's, and has appeared on Nightline, 60 Minutes, and many Fox News programs. Dr. Steele, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
In one of your articles, you said that the real trouble between the races in America is that the races are not just races, but competing power groups. Would you explain what you meant by that?
Well, yes. Given America's history, the beginning obviously with slavery and the blacks being brought in from largely from Africa and set up in America as in this burgeoning society, primarily settled by Europeans, white Europeans, and then there's this infusion of black slaves. We're sort of still bound in that sort of binary relationship, white, black, and throughout history, the two groups have in a sense evolved as power groups in relation to each other. Blacks had very little, any power at all, during 3.5 centuries of slavery. Whites had enormous power in relation to blacks until slavery ended. Then they sort of gained power again in the Jim Crow era. And since the 60s, we've been sort of renegotiating that relationship. Where do blacks have the kind of power in relation to whites in American life that they should have if given that we are a free society focused on individuals rather than on groups.
So you see it more as not so much racial groups as power groups.
That's in terms of our we are races, though that's breaking down actually. But the differential in power between white people and black people throughout American history was really problematic, created a schism, a division in our society that we're still very much struggling with, and we've come into a new phase of that relationship, but it's still based on power, and blacks have gained enormous power since the 60s, since the civil rights victories of the 1960s. We won our in a sense we finally won our freedom then, and again we at least theoretically, we have now a level of power in American life that is commensurate with whites. Though it's very tenuous, we're back into all sorts of issues remain. Most recently, people are talking about reparations again. We're still negotiating that power, the relationship between the two. Am I now finally equal or not? Are whites still locked into a racist position that gives them an advantage or not? It depends on who you talk to, what answer you get there. Much of our politics comes out of that abrasive. In fact, I think really the American democracy is in many ways defined by its relationship to this human problem of race. That's what distinguishes us from almost any other country in the world.
In that same article, Dr. Steele, you pointed out that whenever people make race an important issue, power is the primary motive, and it's kind of along the same lines. Can you give us a specific example of this and also explain how things like innocence, superiority, and entitlement, all of which you've written about, how they factor into it?
Again, we have this it's I wrote a piece recently about this. it begins, I think, came to our attention nationally in the 60s, when America, for the very first time, after blacks had been here from the very beginning of America, the colonial era, finally in the 1960s, white America, through the government, from the President Johnson on down, acknowledged that the United States of America, the freest country in the country that had evolved and articulated freedom through its constitution more eloquently and precisely than any other civilization in the world, that America also practiced probably the most pernicious, prolonged instance of human evil in all of history. 4 centuries of dehumanizing, brutalizing, oppressing a vast number of millions of people simply because of the color of their skin. Wow. There is the American original sin. And it was again in the 60s that this finally was acknowledged. And wow, when something that big, we still not comprehended how big an event that was historically and culturally. And at that point, suddenly America had to scramble and fight to recover its moral authority. As I say, it had to somehow establish that it was innocent of all those past sins, that this was a new America, a new day, and that we were finally past that and determined to never go back there again and so forth. That became a burden on white Americans particularly. That's not been well acknowledged. But whites live under this awesome pressure to prove their innocence of racism, that they are not racist. And, of course, if they fail to do this at this point in our history, they're banished. You can look at the career of people like Roseanne Barr, where someone is literally vaporized by, you know, nothing more than innuendo of racism. Well, again, that is, I think, the overall situation that we often forget. And so power in America has changed. Now power in America, in order to really have it, you have to indicate that you are innocent of America's evil past. That defines power today. That's why we have political correctness. That's why we have identity politics. These group-focused things are opportunities. That's why the entire university system in America has been taken over by political correctness. These institutions are proving their innocence of racism. See, we're not racist. We worry about microaggressions. Everything is diversity this and diversity that. We're innocent. We're not like that evil America.
You talk about microaggressions a lot, and just so our listeners can follow you, can you give us one or two examples of what you mean by microaggressions?
Well, believe me, it's not my idea. it's one.
You're right, I know that.
It is an idea that a way of saying that, you know, if whites are guilty of. Even if you use the word black in the wrong context, oh my gosh, you have committed a microaggression and it's what's the other word? Trigger. You have triggered in me anxieties as a black, and I'm worried and discomforted by this, and so therefore you have to watch out for. And, you know, in literature classes now, they go through things like Huck Finn, Mark Twain's masterpiece of a novel, but very rarely assigned anymore because the N-word is used. Why is the N-word so difficult? I grew up, I read it, it wasn't a big deal. People spoke that way back then. But now, today, in our atmosphere, when innocence is everything, an English teacher who would assign a book like that would be in trouble. That's power.
Sure.
It is often a very destructive power.
Dr. Steele, in the same vein, I find that you have a very unique unique way of looking at freedom. You say that freedom makes you feel your inadequacy. What do you mean by that?
Yes. Well, okay, you come from a group of people, as I do, that were oppressed for four centuries. The one thing we didn't have and that we didn't have to grapple with and deal with was freedom. We didn't have it. We were told what to do, what we were going to be, how we were going to survive. All the important decisions in life were handled by other people. That's what it means to be oppressed. Okay, in 1964, Civil Rights Bill, we're suddenly free. To discriminate against a black person in the United States of America after that date, after 64, was a crime. I myself went to court. Well, I was discriminated against in housing. I won. The landlord was fined as heavily as the judge could fine him. Can't do that. I'm free. Okay, but now that I'm free and I am in charge of my life, that is the one thing my culture never had to do, was live in freedom, make decisions on my own, be responsible for the decisions that I make, live with the consequences of my own decisions and actions. And so freedom is a terrorizing thing for people who've never, it's scary for all of us. But if you come from a culture that's not used to dealing with it, that doesn't organize its culture in a way to deal with it, then it's especially difficult. And I think that, excuse me, since the 60s, black America has been struggling to begin to learn how to deal with freedom. So what we usually do it's so intimidating, we usually say to ourselves, well, the truth is that we're not free. Racism is still around every corner. And that's what's holding me back, and that's what's making my life difficult, and is that racism continues in American life. And I protect myself from feeling inadequate, not up to the challenges of freedom. Well, you know, my larger point always is that at this moment in history, freedom is our challenge, not racism. We keep trying to make it racism so we can avoid the terrors of freedom. But that's what we wanted. That's what makes you a full human being, is freedom. And so if there's a little bit of racism still left in American life, so what? It's time for us now to accept the challenges and prepare ourselves for freedom.
You said something fascinating. I read in either one of your books or in an article that you voted against having a course in ethnic culture at San Jose State when you were there. What kind of blowback did you receive as a result, and how did it impact your overall thinking?
Well, it helped me understand. This was back a good time. It was back in the 80s now. And I had suspected it for a long time, but the idea was that I would go along with this ethnic studies class because I was black. And what's the difference between that and what the segregationists used to do? You can't do this because you're black. And so I was, again, reduced by, in this case, people who considered themselves liberal. I was reduced by liberals to my race. There was no idea that I might, for example, disagree with this ethnic studies class, which I did. I thought it was it was not going to be a very good class. It was highly politicized. It wasn't really a serious literature class. Well, that kind of thing opens your eyes, and you see that certain patterns have taken over in society and in our institutions, where what's more important about Shelby Steele is not who he is, not what he makes of himself, but his color. Well, I thought we had won our freedom from that kind of thinking. But we have not. And one of the main reasons we have not is what I've also written a lot about, is white guilt. And the people who wanted me to go along with this and support an ethnic studies program I didn't believe in, those people wanted ethnic studies because it would prove their innocence of racism. They didn't give a you-know-what about what the class would actually do, whether it would be worthwhile from a literary point of view. They didn't care. They wanted a class devoted to ethnic studies so that they could then point to it and say they were on the side of the good. They were innocent of all those of the old evils that America was so guilty of. And that's the sort of syndrome that we've been trapped into. So now I was victimized as a kid by white racism. Then I became victimized by white guilt. And white guilt is a far more dangerous as I say, I would rather deal with a segregationist than with white guilt.
You know, speaking of white guilt, and the first book of yours that I read was White Guilt. It's an amazing book. I would encourage all of our listeners to get a copy. It really opened my eyes. I think it was when you were at Coke College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I think it was there you described storming into the president's office with other student activists, and you made a series of demands. And looking back on that incident, what would you say to a young Shelby Steele today to help him see why his actions were probably counterproductive?
I'd have a lot to say to him today. It was, again, this was in the late 60s, and Civil Rights Bill had passed, and we'd moved from the sort of Martin Luther King peace-oriented civil rights movement to a much more militant, aggressive, highly politicized black militancy. And this, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the worst moments in black American history, because we fell in thrall to the idea that our blackness and the militancy that we brought to it was going to transform and be the way ahead, would lift us up. So we put faith, literally, in our race rather than in ourselves as people. So that Shelby Steele back there was actually thinking in some weird, contorted way that race would be his way ahead, being the blacker than thou. Black and proud. Well, you know, if you're born black, you're going to live and die black. What do you mean? What have you accomplished? What have you made of your life? What are you going to do to get ahead in life? How are you going to have a family and raise children and become a full citizen by just being black? Well, we got lost in that for 50 years now, and that idea still is prevalent on American campuses, and it breaks my heart. It's total futility. We are farther behind whites today than we were in the 1950s by almost every single socioeconomic measure. That's what blackness will do for you. It is the most stifling, stunting sort of idea of yourself that you can have, that you're nothing more than your race, that being black is all-powerful and all-meaningful. Is being white all-powerful and all-meaningful? I don't think so. I think we live in a free society. The focus is on the individual. Who are you? What have you done with your life? What have you made of yourself? And if many people do that, people who happen to be black, you'll look up one day and the whole group will be advanced. But if until the focus is on individual achievement and development, we're not going to get anywhere as a group.
I think Walter Williams made a great statement when he said, "What exactly has Afrocentric culture done for blacks?" And I thought that was just such a great and simple way to put it. And it's not that far removed from what you're saying. You know, let's take a look at the radical left, since they steal all the headlines today. And we just came out of the bar hearings, which were an embarrassing circus. And I think it's kind of related to the whole all the black issues too. Why do you think the radical left is so consumed by hate, the kind of hate we saw in the Kavanaugh hearings and the Barr hearings? And why do you think, if you do, that it's actually this hatred that they harbor is actually their worst enemy?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about that. I guess many people have. When you see hatred like that, usually it's usually, if not always, driven by some subconscious reality that people are not aware of. And I think on the left today, one of the things that the liberalism that we have in American life and have since the 60s, has been sort of grounded in the idea that hatred is, underlying hatred very often like that is a sense of impotence. And one of the things I think that the left in America faces today is the fact that they no longer have a menace, a large evil to fight. That's what made left the liberalism since the 60s so powerful, is that they were going to save us from racism. They were going to save us from militarism, from America's propensity for evil and bigotry. They're going to save us from all those things. What they neglected to realize was those things faded. They're not altogether gone, but they're not enough, they're not powerful enough anymore to warrant the politics that and the political power that liberalism asks for. They're diminished. Well, it's like you're in a rock fight, but then you look over there and you don't have any rocks in your pile anymore. Liberalism is in a sense, they don't. What is it? What are they fighting for? They can't tell you. And all they can do is tell you who they hate. So hatred is sort of the last refuge of a politics that is exhausted and no longer has anything really alive in it at all.
Do you think this could possibly be at the heart of why climate change seems to be replacing racism
Absolutely.
As public enemy number one?
You're right on the money. You're right on the money. Climate change is going to take the place of racism. There has to be a huge menace. And so racism is really declined to significantly. Racism is not holding anybody back anymore. So what is liberalism? They have no justification. So they scratch the ground and come up with climate change, which now we've got evil again. Climate change, of course, their whole main point is not that, because the climate always changes, but their main point is that human beings are ruining the earth. The same old evil that was behind racism is now behind climate change. And that's why we as liberals have to... That's why we exist, and that's what we have to fight for. And that's why you should give us power, because we're innocent of that evil.
You mentioned reparations earlier, and I don't want to dwell on it, but I have two questions for you on this. First of all, and I'm still looking for the answer, who has the omniscience to sort out who is entitled to reparations and how much each entitled person should receive? And secondly, if the Democrats were ever able to pass legislation for reparations, what do you, Shelby Steele, think the real life consequences would be?
Well, that's a good question. I think they would be they would be rather devastating. I think again, reparations is an idea that has comes back every now and then. It's never going to go anywhere, I don't think, thankfully. But it comes back because we're again afraid. We're trying to keep alive this old paradigm of black victimization and white guilt. We've been surviving on that. We created an entire grievance industry on the basis of that paradigm. Blacks as victims, whites as guilty, who will redeem themselves by helping the victims. So that's faded. Racism is not holding black people back anymore. It's just not. And so we have to, again, come up with things like reparations to try to breathe life back into that old paradigm. And again, so blacks can once again feel that they're victims, and whites can say, okay, we'll throw you a few nickels and dimes and because we're guilty. Everybody's happy. That's what we've been. Well, you're absolutely right. Who would get what? How would we, you know, I guess you'd have to connect yourself somehow to a family member who was a slave or something. What number do we come up with? And how much should I get? 20,000? 200,000? What am I? It's a sad argument because it says that both white and black America are afraid to move on and deal with each other without this sense of jacking each other up over history. Let's drop that. Let's drop the whole get race out of American life as much as possible. Not find ways to bring it back in and keep all the resentments going. So some black kid born today is supposed to what? Get reparations? There is one last argument I have against reparations. I will never, I don't care if they give you $100 million. I will not take it. There's no way you can pay off history. History's what it is. I'm not for taking down monuments. Let those monuments stay there. Buff them up. Let everybody see the reality so that we don't make those mistakes again. But you can't erase history. You can't compensate for history. As I say, Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, they did not win justice. They won freedom for us. Okay, now
that's right. Good.
Thank God,
that's at last.
It's every opportunity is open. We're in the wealthiest, freest society in all of human history. My God, this is our chance finally. So I don't have any time to nurture resentments, and when I do that, you can just bet it's because I don't know how to move forward.
I love your comment. I'm going to definitely use it in an article. Credit you for it. You can't pay off history. Really well said. Getting back to something you touched on, but I'd like you to go into it more specifically. In your book, Shame, you said that the promise of the 60s remains unfulfilled. And a lot of people might be puzzled by that statement, given the considerable progress that has been made in the area of racial injustice, which you yourself have talked about. So how would you answer them and explain that to them?
In terms of the moral evolution of our culture, I think America's made enormous advance. I mean, I don't think it. I know it because I grew up in segregation. I know what that was like. I know what America's like today. I don't think in all of human history a society has made that kind of moral progress. And, you know, I think that sort of speaks for itself. We have made moral progress. But we did not, rather than face freedom and face the challenges that, for example, one of the huge challenges of people coming out of four centuries of oppression is that the education levels are going to be behind. Well, then let's focus there. That's what we should have jumped on. back in the 60s, in academic development, skill development, so that we could make a contribution to society. Well, we didn't do that. We spent our time in identity politics worrying about the black identity as a source of fulfillment. And, well, what's that? That hasn't done anything for us. And so now, 50, 60 years later, we have the lowest grade point averages in every university in America and the highest dropout rate. On every wow. single measurable test, we are at the very bottom. Our income levels are lower than whites. Our marriage rates are lower. Our divorce rates are higher. You go across that profile, and you see in black America, since the 1960s, a precipitous decline. That is tragic. At the very moment, beginning precisely at the moment when we finally gained freedom. Well, you know, what's our problem, racism or freedom? We're behind, and we've not met all the promises of the 60s made. That, oh, we're going to overcome inequality and we're going to so forth. We haven't done any of that. And so, you know, because we, again, I think have been intimidated by the difficult. Freedom is scary and it's demanding. You have to raise your children so that they develop the skills, the emotional energy and power to meet the challenges that a highly competitive, high-tech society like America asks of people. Well, instead of that, you know, you look at the south side of Chicago where I grew up, and you see a collapse of the black family. You see, well, why? Racism is surely not what it was back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when we made actual progress economically and in every other way. But 1964, that very moment when the freedom comes and America acknowledges it's wrong, we begin to decline. That's what happens when a group of people ask another group of people to be responsible for them. This is part of the problem. We keep asking white people to be responsible. I want white people not to be racist. I want fairness everywhere I go in American life. And white people have in many ways seriously begun to live up to that. Some remnants of the old days, but for the most part they've lived up to that. God bless. We didn't ask a damn thing of black people. Nothing.
Well, I guess I think you made it clear what you think of liberalism, but that it's perpetuated the exploitation of blacks. Why do you think conservatism is really the best path to prosperity for blacks?
I don't think conservatism is the best path for blacks. I think it is the only path for blacks. It focuses, it is grounded on the individual. It makes demands of the individual. It advocates individual responsibility, individual initiative, hard work, family values, principles and values that are eternal, that will enable you to be successful no matter who you are, where you are. If you begin to adopt those principles, you will be better off than the alternative of not adopting them. They work. We know that. That America is the greatest country in the world precisely because of those principles. So those principles are the antidote to poverty. Black people need those principles like the breath of life. And everything else is a waste of time, a diversion, a distraction that will just give us more of the sort of muddling mediocrity that we're that we're now sunk in. Where
everything
we're just sort
you just
of
said
biding
is, yeah,
time.
It's, this is a message that needs to be spread far and wide by conservative groups for sure. I'm going to ask you one final question,
yes,
put you on the
spot. And,
here.
And I want one other thing to conservative groups. They should be proud of spreading that message. They should not be.
Absolutely.
They should not feel that. Right now, they are reluctant to do that because they think they'll be called racist when they do that.
You probably agree with me that the first George Bush, when he, as soon as he took office, the first words out of his mouth were, "It's going to be a kinder, gentler conservatism." And to me, that's like apologetic. To me, it's redundant.
Totally.
Because conservatism is kind and gentle. So it was, and
it
and,
is absolutely, yeah, the only way to any real kindness or gentleness is through conservatism.
Yeah, and I think George Bush too said a compassionate conservatism. Well, conservatism is far more compassionate than liberalism. So I agree totally with what you're saying. It's apologetic, and there's nothing to apologize for. But I want to get to this final question. It's an important one, kind of putting you on the spot. But this horrible, horrible disease of identity politics, do you believe we'll see an end to identity politics, or do you think things are only going to get worse in America when it comes to identity politics?
Things may certainly get worse for a while, but identity politics will ultimately, I think, fail because the, you know, they come from the fact that America, because of its ugly racial history, is still strapped by this idea that it doesn't have the moral authority to enforce its own best values and principles. And so we come up with things like identity politics and diversity. I can't remember all the words. The silly, empty ideas, inclusiveness, so forth. We come up with all of those because we lack the moral authority. We feel guilty about the past, and so we're afraid to say what we all know. That again, what we've been talking about, those conservative values are what will address poverty more seriously than and effectively than anything else. So identity politics is a measure of insecurity of our institutions. I think today's Republican, I think Donald Trump is the president because a good section of America today is tired of trying to function without the moral authority to ask for what we know makes sense, for what we know is best. Everybody is terrified. Well, we're going to be called a racist if we insist on what on those the principles that made America great, we're a racist. That's the bind that the left has us in. And there's only one way out of that bind. It's the most difficult. We have to be courageous enough to face that down and say, no, we believe in these values and we are not racist. The people you're trying to help will never get better until they begin to understand the possibility, the richness of life that's available to them through these values.
I want to thank you for being with us today, and I want to encourage all our listeners to be sure and get a copy of your most recent work, Shame, How America's Past Sins Have Polarized Our Country. It's a fabulous book. So thanks again for your great insights. You've given us a great deal to think about. I really hope you'll come back and visit with us again real soon.
I would love to do that. Thank you very much for having me.